Chapter 2. Tea Gardens, Tamangs, and a Talking Calf. Longview was one of the biggest tea estates in the Darjeeling district, but I had heard of its existence only recently when I received a visit from its new South Indian manager, R.A. Padmanathan, who was a reader of the Aryan Path, to which I was a regular contributor. The Aryan Path was printed and published in Bangalore by the Indian Institute of Culture, and the director of the institute was Padmanathan's cousin. On learning from this cousin that the Buddhist monk whose name appeared so frequently in the pages of the institute's journal lived in Kalimpong, thus being virtually his next-door neighbour, Padmanathan lost no time in coming to see me. The visit was followed by an exchange of letters between us, an exchange which culminated towards the end of June in his inviting me to Longview and my accepting the invitation. Though I had been living in the district for over 3 years, I had as yet had no more than a glimpse of the world-famous tea gardens, and the idea of spending a few days in one of them appealed to me. I did not go to Longview alone. Sanchin accompanied me. He was one of my oldest pupils, having attended the evening tutorial classes, which, shortly after the establishment of the now-defunct YMBA, I had started for the benefit of those of our members who were fearful of not passing their school or college examinations. After an unsuccessful attempt at a science degree in Darjeeling, his father had wanted him to be a doctor, he was back in Kalimpong, attending the Scottish University's Mission Arts College, and now came to me for tuition in logic and English literature. Logic we both found interesting, at times even fascinating, but English literature, especially English poetry, was sheer unadulterated delight. Besides going through the Calcutta University's IA prose and poetry sections, page by page and line by line, I dictated paraphrases of the poems to him, the ability to reproduce in your own words the meaning of Wordsworth's Immortality Ode, or Shelley's To the West Wind, being apparently highly prized by the examiners. Not that we confined ourselves to the selections. Sanchin's love of literature was hardly less than my own, and we often wandered in the course of these tutorials far beyond the limits of what was academically prescribed. Love of literature constituted, indeed, a strong bond between us. It had been a major factor in the development of our friendship, which, now that Sanchin was back in Kalimpong, was flourishing more vigorously than ever. Rarely did a day pass without our seeing each other, either at the Hermitage or at the bungalow in the Scottish Mission compound where he lived, and where, if he happened to be out, I sometimes talked with his father, who was a doctor in the Mission Hospital. When Padmanathan invited me to Longview, it was therefore natural that I should tell Sanchin, natural that he would want to accompany me, natural that I should be willing for him to do so, and natural, finally, that we should decide to extend the scope of our excursion and return to Kalimpong via Kurseong and Darjeeling. The evening before our departure, I learnt that Gyan Jyoti's jeep would be going down to Siliguri in the morning. Gyan Jyoti was the prominent Newar Buddhist merchant who had invited Kashyapji, as my teacher was generally known, to Kalimpong, and who, since Kashyapji had taken me there with him and left me there to, quote, work for the good of Buddhism, was indirectly responsible for my presence in the town. Though we did not often meet, he was always ready to oblige me, and thus it was that I travelled to Siliguri in the front seat of his jeep, while Sanchin followed by bus. Within half an hour of our leaving the Hermitage, we had crossed the Teesta Bridge, 3,000 feet below Kalimpong, and was speeding along the muddy, potholed track that wound between the foothills to the plains. The rainy season was well advanced, and I saw that the Teesta had risen dramatically, and that its waters were no longer jade green or turquoise in colour, but a dull ochre laced with soap-suddy yellow. There had already been a few landslides, but the road had been cleared, and the other occupants of the jeep and I were beginning to congratulate ourselves on an uneventful journey, when, only a few miles from the plains, we suddenly found our passage blocked by three enormous boulders. These had to be dynamited out of the way before we could proceed, with the result that it took 5 hours instead of the expected three to reach the would-be industrial shanty town that was Siliguri, where the Longview jeep was waiting. Half an hour later, having been swallowed by the rolling green acres of the tea gardens, which extended up into the first range of foothills, Sanchez and I were being deposited at the entrance to the manager's bungalow and welcomed by Padmanathan. According to the dictionary, a bungalow was a one-story house, but the building in which we now found ourselves, and where we were soon partaking of a late lunch with our host, was more like a country mansion than the modest suburban dwelling that, in England at least, the Hindi-derived term had come to designate. The table at which we sat could have accommodated 20 people, while the enormous dresser that stood against one wall and the massive sideboard that stood against another held, respectively, dinner services and glass and silverware that must have been shipped from England decades ago. Obviously, in these spacious days of the Raj, the manager of a Darjeeling tea estate had lived in considerable splendour, waited on by a horde of servants and entertaining lavishly. In this respect, at least, Padmanathan was far from emulating his imperial predecessors. He lived very simply, making use of only a few of the 20-odd lofty rooms, keeping only a handful of servants, and doing little or no entertaining. Though clad, as no doubt his predecessors had been clad, in khaki shorts and open-necked shirt, he did not really give the impression of being the manager of an important tea estate. With his serious expression and mild manners, he gave the impression, rather, of being a college professor or not very successful lawyer. Lunch was not only late but lengthy, Padmanathan having a lot to say to me, and after the meal Sanchin and I barely had a chance to try out the bungalow's ping-pong table before it was time for afternoon tea and a visit to the temple. When he took over, Padmanathan explained, there was not a single place of worship in the whole estate. He had therefore built the labourers a temple, and from the way he showed this to us, it was clear he was quite proud of the little whitewashed structure on the edge of the labour force's assembly ground. It was open-fronted and divided into two compartments, each with its own bell. One compartment contained images of Radha and Krishna, both standing. The other, a sedent image of the Buddha. Having shown us the temple, Padmanathan took us to see first the tea gardens, with their thousands of rows of flat-topped bushes, and then the various offices. Though our host drove us round for quite a while, we were far from seeing the whole estate, which, he informed us, comprised 1,500 acres, and had a labour force of 3,000. Most of the labourers were Tamangs, which meant they were Buddhists. But according to Padmanathan, they were totally ignorant of Buddhism and had in fact no interest in religion. The rest of the labourers were either Tapas or other Nepalese Hindus, or, though there were very few of these, Nepalese Christian converts. By the time we returned to the bungalow, Sanchin and I had seen and heard so much that was new to us that we felt quite tired and were content simply to sit on the veranda without speaking. Situated on a ridge as it was, the bungalow commanded a breathtakingly extensive view of the plains, and as darkness fell, the embalmed darkness of the tropics, we could see the lights of Siliguri twinkling in the distance. How was it, I wondered, that a place that looks so sordid by day could contrive to present so magical an appearance at night? But I did not wander for long. The air was cold, my mosquito-curtained bed was inviting, and we had to be up at 5 o'clock in order to accompany Padmanathan to the assembly ground and see the labour force being given its orders for the day. If I had expected to see dawn break next morning on 3,000 heads, then I was disappointed. Only 400 or 500 men, women and children actually turned up, many of them carrying the traditional tokri or cone-shaped wicker basket. They were, I had to admit, an unattractive lot. Though sturdily built, they were for the most part squat, bandy-legged, low-browed and broad-featured, with expressions that ranged from the dull and apathetic to the coarse and brutal, so that one had to remind oneself that these were human beings, and as such one's brothers and sisters, even one's brother and sister Buddhists. When the force had assembled, and it was obvious no more labourers would be turning up that day, Padmanathan made his way to the temple, stepped inside the first compartment, rang the bell, put on his spectacles, and read out 2 verses from the Bhagavad Gita. He then stepped into the second compartment, rang the bell there too, read out 2 verses from the Dhammapada, took off his spectacles, and rejoined the little band of assistants and overseers with whom he had been talking. The assembled labourers took no interest in these proceedings. Bara Saheb's job is to run the estate, their sullen looks seemed to say, if they said anything at all. Religion is the job of Brahmins and Lamas. For Padmanathan had engaged a Nepalese Brahmin to officiate in the Hindu half of the temple, and a Tamang Lama to officiate in the Buddhist half, and the 2 functionaries were in obsequious attendance upon him as he performed his own supernumerary ministrations. These ministrations over, he was free to give the labour force, or as much of it as had turned up, his orders for the day, which he did through the medium of the overseers, his own Nepali being insufficient for that purpose. The overseers then led off their respective contingents to various parts of the estate, while Padmanathan took Sanchin and me to his office for breakfast. After breakfast, our host showed us more of the estate, this time initiating us into the mysteries of the tea-producing process, from the picking of the 2 leaves and a bud with which the process began, to the dispatching of the big, fragrant wooden chests with which it concluded. Picking was usually done by women, Padmanathan explained, as we looked out over one of the gardens, where scores of pairs of female hands were working with incredible rapidity, right hand and left hand alternately tossing the young shoots and leaves back over the picker's shoulders into her tokri. Women were in any case more reliable than men, he continued, because they had children to feed, they worked regularly, whereas the men worked only when they needed liquor money and were often drunk for days on end. The bushes on which the shoots and leaves grew were, I noticed, all no more than breast high, for though the tea plant was really a tree belonging to the same family as the camellia, in cultivation its growth was restricted for the convenience of the picker. It was no doubt for the same reason that the tops of the bushes were kept perfectly flat. Planted out, as they were at regular intervals, in long, straight rows, the neat little bushes gave the hillside something of the appearance of a Dutch formal garden of clipped yew. Each time a picker filled her tokri, she took it to the overseer, who weighed it and entered the weight against her name in a little book. At the end of the day, the weights were added up, and she would be paid according to the total. Thus, the faster she worked, the greater would be the number of times she filled her tokri, and the greater the number of times she filled her tokri, the more she would be paid. In this way, an active young woman could earn what, by local standards, was a good wage. From the gardens, the freshly picked shoots and leaves were transported to a factory, where they went through the remaining stages of the tea-producing process, all of which Padmanathan showed us. The unfortunate herb was spread on trays, rolled, fermented, baked, and tortured in a variety of other ways, before being sifted into grades and packed ready for dispatch to Calcutta. For the whole time we were inside the factory, I was not only conscious of the extreme humidity, I was also conscious of a pervasive, overpowering odour, the odour of tea. It was an odour reminiscent not of the delicate aroma wafted from the 4 o'clock incarnation of, quote, the cup that cheers but does not inebriate, but rather of the stench emanating from yesterday's used tea leaves. I was therefore not sorry when, our initiation into the mysteries of tea production being complete, Sanchin and I eventually emerged with Padmanathan into the comparative coolness of the air outside and were taken back to the bungalow, where my host and I at once plunged into a serious discussion, a discussion that lasted until lunchtime and was continued in the evening. The fact of the matter was that I was deeply concerned about the Tamang labourers, who after all comprised by far the greater part of the Longview labour force. They were Buddhists in the sense that they had been born into Buddhist families. More precisely, they were Nyingma Buddhists, that is, followers of Padmasambhava, the precious guru, one of the two co-founders of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Yet, according to Padmanathan, they were totally ignorant of Buddhism and had no interest in religion. Something had to be done, and done quickly, since otherwise they might cease in the course of another generation to be Buddhists even in name. The idea that eventually occurred to me as Padmanathan and I talked, and which I at once communicated to him, was that he should establish a branch of the Mahabodhi Society at Longview, a branch that would be responsible for spreading the basic teachings of Buddhism among the labour force, and which I myself would visit regularly. Within a few years, the Tamangs would be completely changed. They would be Buddhists, in fact, as well as in name, and true followers of the precious guru. Though Padmanathan did not mislike the idea of there being a branch of the Mahabodhi Society at Longview, he was far from sharing my confidence that it could be a means of changing the Tamangs. I had seen for myself, he commented ruefully, how little interest the labourers took in what went on inside the temple. It had been a great disappointment to him. At least some of them, he had thought, would get into the habit of going to the temple to pray, whether to the Buddha or to Radha Krishna, it didn't really matter to whom, and to offer the Lama or the Brahmin a few annas. But none of them ever did. A few of the Hindu office staff sometimes went to the temple, but the Tamang and other labourers gave it a wide berth. The nearest the latter ever got to it was when they came to the assembly ground to be given their orders for the day, and even then they took no more notice of the temple than if it had been an ordinary building. It was as though they did not appreciate what had been done for them. Later on, Sanchin having joined us, Padmanathan returned to the theme. Not only had he built the labourers a temple, he had also provided them with a free dispensary, but they steadfastly refused to avail themselves of its services, preferring to rely instead on old wives' remedies of their own when they felt sick or were injured. It was the same in the case of the shop he had opened for their benefit. This too they refused to patronise, even though they could buy provisions there at wholesale prices. He couldn't understand them. They seemed not to respond to kindness. Why, when asked which of his various predecessors they had liked best, they invariably mentioned the name of Mr. So-and-so, a British manager, who abused them and swore at them, who was very free with his fists, and who was not above laying into them with a whip. Sometimes, he thought, our host added, that if they had a voice in the matter, the labourers of Longview would vote to bring back Mr. So-and-so, whip and all. Next day, I had another serious discussion, this time with the Deputy Commissioner, Sri Dutt Majumdar, whom I had already met once or twice. He arrived a couple of hours before lunch, having come to confer with Padmanathan on a problem that had lately arisen and which he was having to deal with, the problem of the infiltration of some of the tea estates by communist agitators. The Communist Party, or parties, was not illegal in India. Those were, in any case, the heady days of Indo-Chinese friendship, when, according to the popular slogan, the peoples of India and China were brothers, friends, mates. But agitation in the tea estates could lead to strikes, strikes to loss of production, and loss of production to loss of foreign exchange, tea being one of India's most valuable exports. As Deputy Commissioner, Dutt Majumdar was therefore concerned with the matter. Infiltration by communists was also of concern, it seemed, to the good fathers of North Point, the famous Catholic college on the outskirts of Darjeeling. One of their number had recently called on him at his office, so Dutt Majumdar informed me, to report that the English Buddhist monk who lived in Kalimpong was in fact a communist spy, and to suggest that in the interests of national security he should be expelled from the district. "I know very well why he reported you," Dutt Majumdar smilingly assured me. "You have nothing to worry about." I too knew why the Jesuit father had reported me. Indeed, I thought I knew the reason for his action better than Dutt Majumdar himself did. It was not merely that, in accordance with my teacher's behest, I was working in Kalimpong for the good of Buddhism, thus diminishing the influence of the missionaries, Catholic and Protestant alike, in what they were accustomed to regard as their very own territory. A few months earlier, I had sent to the Calcutta English Language Dailies a letter exposing a particularly odious method of obtaining conversions to Christianity that had come to my notice in Kalimpong. And the publication of this letter had aroused the wrath of the missionary fraternity throughout northeastern India and made me even more notorious among them than I was already. The method in question was that of conversion through pregnancy, as I termed it. A Christian girl would be encouraged to associate with a non-Christian boy, who, when she became pregnant, would be pressurized by the mission authorities, first into agreeing to marry her, then into agreeing to marry her in church, and finally, since only Christians could be married in church, into agreeing to become a Christian. Sometimes the pressure included threats of physical violence. All this I explained to Dutt Majumdar, who was naturally interested, the more especially since the boys whose cases I mentioned came from communities entitled to official protection from exploitation by outside agencies. He therefore asked me to let him have the facts in writing, at the same time promising to take action into the matter. When Sanchin and I took leave of Padmanathan that afternoon, I was well content with the success of our visit, and had much to think about as the long-view jeep zigzagged up the succession of hairpin bends that led to Kurseon. At Kurseon, we spent an hour or two at the TB Sanatorium, visiting Lachuman, an old pupil of mine, who was now a patient there, then caught the bus to Darjeeling. On my previous visits to Darjeeling, I had been the guest of a hospitable Punjabi shopkeeper, but he was out of station, as the phrase went, and I decided to stay at the Gandharmadan Vihara instead. Situated on the sheer hillside below the main road into Darjeeling, the Gandharmadan Vihara was the religious and cultural centre of the town's two or three dozen Bauru families, the Bauruas being Theravadin Buddhists from East Bengal. It comprised a small shrine-cum-lecture hall, a row of guest rooms, and a one-room wooden kuti for the use of the resident bhikshu. At that time, there was no resident bhikshu, nor had there been one, I gathered, for several years. There was, however, an orange-robed guest, in the person of the same Burmese Mahathera, or great elder, who had once visited me in Kalimpong, and whom I had put up for the night. With him I therefore renewed acquaintance, having breakfast with him the next morning, and accompanying him to the house of Kali Kinka Barua, the secretary of the local Bengal Buddhist Association, for a Bhojana Dana, or ceremonial food offering. I also renewed acquaintance during that and the following day with two leading members of the Tamang Buddhist Association, besides spending time with personal friends and visiting the town's English bookshops with Sanchin, who was staying with his maternal grandmother. The two members of the Tamang Buddhist Association were brisk, dapper little P.T. Lama and his big, pan-chewing brother, Inspector T. Mokton. The latter, who was in the West Bengal Police, was the more religious-minded of the two, and always came to see me when his duties took him to Kalimpong. A widower with two small daughters, he had decided, most uncharacteristically for a Nepalese, not to remarry. Though the two brothers were looking for me, and I was looking for them, we did not meet until we happened to bump into each other in the bazaar. They at once took me to the Tamang Gompa, as the pagoda-style Nyingma temple was called, and showed me the new mani chamber they were constructing there. A mani was a prayer wheel, or, more accurately, a prayer cylinder, and a mani chamber was a chamber containing not a prayer cylinder such as was twirled by old-fashioned Tibetans as they took their evening stroll, but a giant version of the same devotional aid, a version which in this case would stand 8 or 10 feet high and occupy practically the entire chamber. They were constructing the mani chamber in memory of their mother, the brothers explained. It was nearly completed, as I could see, and they would like me to speak at the opening ceremony. I at once accepted the invitation. The principal object of worship in the Tamang Gompa was the enormous sedent image of Padmasambhava that had given me 3 years ago so overwhelming an impression of the spiritual reality of the precious guru, and I was happy to renew my connection with the place. I also accepted the invitation because I knew that even educated Buddhists like P.T. Lama and Inspector T. Mokton knew very little about Buddhism, and I was glad, while remaining personally not keen on prayer cylinders, to have the opportunity of explaining the meaning of an ancient Buddhist tradition. A few weeks later, therefore, I was back in Darjeeling and back at the Gandhamadan Vihara. This time, Sanchin did not accompany me. He was more than willing to do so, but according to the Hindu calendar, both the days for which I would be away were inauspicious, and his mother did not want him to be away from home then. On arriving in Darjeeling, I again renewed acquaintance with the Burmese Mahathera, then spent the remainder of the day seeing people, visiting bookshops, and executing various small commissions for Sanchin and Miss Barclay. The day concluded with a three-cornered philosophical discussion between me and two Bengali Hindu friends, a discussion which lasted until the stroke of midnight. Next morning, after an early Bhojana Dana at the home of Kali Kinka Barua, I made my way down the hillside to the Tamang Gompa, my host escorting me. The opening of the new mani chamber was a public occasion, with the Deputy Commissioner Sri Dutch Majumdar presiding, and my own lecture as the principal item on the programme. I had decided to speak on the meaning of the mantra Om Mani Padme Hung Hri, this being the mantra embossed on the great copper cylinder that stood awaiting the push that would give it its first ponderous revolution on its axis. A good part of my lecture was devoted to explaining the significance of the jewel, or mani, and the lotus, Padma, which were, I said, universal symbols, being found in different forms all over the world. In the words of the summary I afterwards wrote of the lecture, quote, "The lotus grows in water, and water always represents life. Philosophically speaking, life is what we call samsara, the repeated process of birth and death. Life and birth are closely connected, and for this reason, the lotus stands for the garbha, the feminine principle, as well. It also represents the heart and the emotions, since these are both associated with the feminine principle. The jewel, on the other hand, symbolizes light. Light represents knowledge. The source of light is the sun, the heat of which fecundates the earth. The mani, or jewel, therefore represents the active generating power, the masculine principle. Since reason is supposed to predominate in man, it also stands for reason, intellect, and spiritual understanding." In explaining the significance of these two symbols, I was careful to insist that whereas a concept had only one meaning, a symbol suggested innumerable meanings, so that the significance of a symbol could never be exhausted intellectually. It was therefore possible to interpret the words Mani Padme, literally, "the jewel is in the lotus," in a number of ways. They could signify the presence of a spiritual reality behind the veil of appearances, or the fact that every man and woman possess the potentiality for enlightenment, or the desirability of harmonizing the rational and emotional sides of our personality. Thus, the meaning of Mani Padme was not abstract and philosophical, but concrete and practical, and might be summarized as follows. Quote, "All our thinking is in terms of pairs of opposites. We think of the true and false, right and wrong, etc. The jewel and the lotus represent the ultimate duality of existence. In China, these two principles are called yang and yin. In India, they are sometimes called Purusha and Prakriti, Shiva and Shakti. When we say that the jewel is in the lotus, we are reminding ourselves that things are not really separate from each other, and that our dualistic way of looking at things is a delusion. When we realize by a spiritual practice that duality is only the creation of our own minds, we become enlightened." End of quote. The references to Purusha and Prakriti, Shiva and Shakti, were for the benefit of the Hindu members of the audience, the opening of the new Mani Chamber being not only a very public occasion, but something of an interfaith one as well. It was not that I really believed in the possibility of establishing an exact correspondence between Buddhist and Hindu symbols. Besides explaining the meaning of the mantra, I sought to account for the effect produced by its repetition. Words were sounds, and sounds consisted of vibrations. Every word we uttered not only conveyed a meaning, but set up certain vibrations, which could be either harmonious or discordant. It was these vibrations, and not the rational content of the words, which influenced us most deeply. And it was possible for us to be influenced in this way, because we too were made up of vibrations. Not only our physical bodies, but our minds as well, were vibrating at a certain rate. Everything in the universe vibrated. Buddhism and science agreed that nothing in the world was solid, but that everything was in a state of perpetual oscillation. At this point, I referred to an American scientist's success in measuring the power of mantra vibrations numerically by means of radiation, particularly radiesthesia. The highest rate at which a mantra could vibrate, according to this authority, was 250,000 times a second. Several mantras vibrated at this rate, the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum
being among them. This information, which I had gleaned from the writings of the tantric scholar Dr. Benoitosh Bhattacharya, was music to the ears of my Tamang Buddhist friends, as was the information gleaned from the same source that the vibration of a mani cylinder released beneficial cosmic forces in favour of the person revolving it. When I sent a copy of the printed summary of my lecture to Lama Govinda, however, he responded with a flat rejection of the idea that the emotional and spiritual effect of a mantra had anything to do with its vibrational value as measured by a scientific device. Mechanistic interpretations of this kind, he roundly declared, were rank materialism, and as such were quite inconsistent with the principles of true Buddhism. In deference to his superior understanding of the subject, I therefore never reprinted the little article in which I had summarised my lecture at the opening of the Tamang Gompa's new Mani Chamber. But years later, particularly after becoming acquainted with Pythagoreanism, I sometimes wondered, Pesi Lama Govinda, whether there might not be a correlation, even a correlation expressible in mathematical terms, between the numerical frequencies and ratios that obtained in the outside world and human emotions, and whether the one might not conceivably have an effect on the other. The new Mani chamber having been opened and the massive cylinder given its initial push, I returned to the Gandhamadan Vihara and spent the next few hours absorbed in one of the books I had bought the previous day. It was T.S. Eliot's The Use of Poetry and the Use of Criticism. In my lecture, I'd spoken of the desirability of harmonising the rational and emotional sides of our personality. There were certainly sides of my own personality that needed to be harmonised and integrated, though these were not so much the rational and the emotional as the religious and the aesthetic. Sometimes the two overlapped, even coincided, but more often they remained separate and distinct, even mutually antagonistic. This meant that usually they tended to alternate, sometimes even within the space of a single day, with now one and now the other predominating, whether in respect of my inner preoccupations or my outward activities. On the day of the opening ceremony, this was certainly the case. Having given a lecture on the meaning of a Buddhist mantra in the morning and spent the afternoon absorbed in English literary criticism, in the evening I attended the full moon day puja in the Vihara's shrine cum lecture hall, administering the five precepts to the assembled bearers and delivering my first sermon in Hindi. On returning to Kalimpong the next day, I found the town in an uproar. At least the Hindu part of it was in an uproar. A butcher had been about to cut the throat of a calf when the innocent creature opened its mouth and said, apparently in good Nepali, "Have mercy, don't kill me, I am holy mother cow." News of the miracle spread like wildfire. Pious Hindus flocked from all parts of the town to have darshan of the calf, to prostrate themselves before it, and to implore its blessing. Neck profusely garlanded with marigolds, and forehead smeared with vermilion, it was taken in procession through the bazaar amid scenes of tremendous enthusiasm. Whenever it stopped for a moment, people pressed forward to dip their fingers in the precious deposit and apply it to their foreheads, cow dung being endued, for orthodox Hindus, with all kinds of purificatory properties. Money was also collected on behalf of the now deified calf, and at the end of an hour the fortunate quadruped was the richer by 35,000 rupees. The principal contributors were the saffroned, turbaned Marwari merchants, who occupied a prominent position in the town's economy, and who are known as much for their strict Hindu orthodoxy as for their business acumen. A piece of land was being purchased for the calf, I was told, and a shed cum temple erected where it would be able to live out its days in peace. As for the butcher who had been the witness of the miracle, he had forsworn his sanguinary trade and become a vegetarian, and was going to spend the rest of his life in the calf's service as its priest and personal attendant. The majority of our members, especially the younger ones, did not believe the calf had actually spoken, least of all that it had claimed to be Holy Mother Cow in person. There was general agreement, though, that something strange must have happened in the butcher's shed. Perhaps the butcher experienced a sudden revulsion as he lifted his knife against the innocent creature, a revulsion so strong that he thought he heard the calf speaking and begging him to spare its life. A few of our members rejected even this rationalistic explanation. The whole thing was a deliberate hoax, they declared. There had been no talking calf, no repentant butcher. The story had been fabricated by the local branch of the All India Cow Protection Society. They had fabricated it in order to whip up support for their flagging anti-cow slaughter campaign, and Hindu popular sentiment, always volatile, had done the rest. To me it was obvious the cow protectionists had been involved, if only to the extent of taking advantage of a rumour favourable to their cause, and I was pleased some of our members had seen through their machinations. A few weeks earlier I had started a new series of weekly lectures at the Hermitage. One lecture was entitled How to Develop Discrimination, and it had led to some lively discussion. In Kalimpong, as elsewhere, one had to learn to discriminate between religion and superstition, between individual devotion and collective hysteria, and the knowledge that some of my closer associates were beginning to do this was very heartening.
End of chapter 2.